Okay, so the initial sort of question is whether or not the doctor was negligent in failing to diagnose this earlier. What's the plaintiff's argument as to what a reasonably prudent doctor would have done? Okay, but the plaintiff's argument actually doesn't start there. The plaintiff's argument starts with, I mean, that's basically the defendant's argument, isn't it, of what the standard of care is. Right. What the plaintiff would start out with before the defendant brings that up would be to say, gee, this is a simple test. It would detect this disease in time to be able to prevent it from harming the plaintiff's vision. And I don't know if it's a disease, but a condition in any event. And therefore, a reasonable person would have done that. So the plaintiff's argument is just kind of, duh, why wouldn't a reasonable person have given this test sooner? The defendant's argument, by contrast, is, okay. So, what happens at the trial of the case? Well, actually, there was an instruction about that. The jury was told what? And more specifically, that what's the relationship between a finding of negligence on the part of the physician and the standard of care observed by the profession? Tell me how those two things relate. The standard of reasonable care as compared to, or how does that relate to the standard of care adopted by the profession? What's the relationship between those two? According to the judge, a physician can only be held negligent if they fail to meet the standard observed by ophthalmologists. So that's what the plaintiff didn't like about the instruction, right? That the jury was told, in effect, pay no attention to what you might think as mere mortals. You have to look to the profession to tell you what is or is not reasonable care. What's the plaintiff's complaint about that instruction? Okay, and on what authority can we sweep aside the what the profession tells us about what a reasonable ophthalmologist can do, should do? By what authority? Who's done that before? In whose footsteps we may follow? Mr. Reich? Well, the guy who did it was Learned Hand. Yeah, he did it in the T.J. It wasn't some guy named T.J. Hoover who did this, I wanted to make clear. But we've been there, done that, in terms of having an industry say, in effect, who are you to tell us how to run the railroad? Why, we are the court. We're lawyers. We can do anything. So the plaintiff says, apply the logic of T.J. Hooper and give the jury the freedom and the power they deserve to be able to say, you ophthalmologists, you have fallen short of reasonable care. That's the plaintiff's argument. What says the majority? The majority in Helling versus Carey, in response to this, claimed that the jury should have had the freedom to judge the medical profession rather than letting However persuasive be its usages, you know, a whole calling may have fallen behind the standard. Okay, what does the court say to that? Yeah, they say the plaintiff was not well treated by the trial judge. The plaintiff was denied this opportunity to teach the ophthalmologists a lesson. Ordinarily, if there's an error in the jury instructions, what do we do procedurally? Right. Send it back to, it would have to be another jury. We can't reconstitute the same jury, but we'll try this case again. A new jury will have these facts presented to them, and then they will have the chance to argue that the doctors were set too low a standard, and the doctors can reply by showing that their standard was reasonable. But that isn't what happens here. What does the majority say we should do? Yes, that they say there's liability here as a matter of law. Why? Okay, and while we're at it, where have we heard that kind of analysis before? It's our old friend Learned Hand again. You know, not only do we use him for purposes of the T.J. Hooper case to say you can hold an entire calling or industry to have been substandard, but you can also employ this kind of cost-benefit comparison to look at the burden as compared to what's the probability of loss and the magnitude of harm. Now, interestingly, just while we're doing the numbers game here, it turns out that we have at least one number here with respect to the probability of loss. What's the probability of loss here? Yeah. So we have statistics that show that the failure to give the pressure test creates a risk. A 1 in 25,000 ophthalmology patients is going to lose the chance to have early detection of glaucoma and treatment for it. We could actually figure out, I think, what the burden is. At least we can put some kind of estimate on it. Those of you who've gone to an eye doctor and gotten one of these little, you know, pressure tests, give me a number as to what it costs to give each patient, not just those over 40, but every patient, this glaucoma test. Give me a number. $5. I'll take that. Okay, so the burden over here is $5. Now, the only thing that's left to figure out is, doing the math here, if the cost of a case of glaucoma is more than $125,000, then it's worth it. You would be negligent if you failed to give your patient this pressure test. That's their logic, it appears. And so the majority says, as a matter of law, we find this doctor to have been negligent. Now, obviously, the reason for this case is not just to give you another little refresher on Learned Hand and the Carol Towing case and T.J. Hooper and so forth. It's to compare the majority opinion with the concurring opinion. What does the concurring opinion suggest is the proper way to resolve this case? Okay, so the concurring opinion is uncomfortable with the majority's determination that the whole ophthalmology profession had acted negligently. I mean, certainly the judges would be entitled to look at this and be puzzled. Why wouldn't you give this test? But there is something a little bit, more than a little bit, arrogant in the judges of the Supreme Court saying, in effect, this whole profession, you know, we will now tell these people how to practice medicine. So the concurring opinion says, so what's the disposition of the case here? I mean, if it would be inappropriate for the majority to call the defendant in this case negligent, and sort of gratuitously insulting, what does the concurring opinion propose we should do with the plaintiff's claim? They'll have to pay anyway on the basis of strict liability, says the concurring opinion. Now, if I understand the concurring opinion, which is I'm not sure I do, what is it that the concurring opinion is proposing as a standard for resolving cases like this? Remembering that as we decide what the rules are in cases like this, we tell people out there who are running businesses and, you know, doing stuff out there in the world, here is the dividing line. Here are the areas where you can be held liable for injuries. Here are the areas where if you are injured, you can expect to be compensated, and so forth. Just so we're clear on how that works, as I turn the keys in my car, getting ready to drive to work this morning, what does society tell me is the expectation that I should have with respect to injuries I might cause or injuries that I might suffer driving my car? What's the rule? Is that the rule? So that if I'm driving down the street and some little kid, you know, runs out in the street in front of me with no warning and I run this kid over, I have to pay for that? Ms. Harkins, you're shaking your head no. Well, let's go back to driving my car, though. What's the rule for driving my car? What rule does society tell me I operate under when I'm driving my car? Okay, so what society tells me is I will be held liable, but only if it's proven that I was negligent. You know, if I swat a wasp and the jury decides that's something a reasonably prudent person wouldn't have done, or, you know, they're going to resolve the question based upon the standard of reasonable care. Similarly, if I get injured on the highway, someone else runs into me, what does society tell me I can expect by way of compensation? Yeah, if I want to recover from a semi-truck driver or, you know, someone else who causes my injury, I have to prove that they were negligent. That's the coin of the realm with respect to driving my car down the street. So inquiring minds want to know, inquiring minds who practice ophthalmology want to know, well, fortunately, these guys are writing a concurring opinion. They only get, what is it, two votes here? I forget how many people vote for this opinion. Three votes? Finley, Hamilton, and Utter. So there are three votes out of nine. A third of the court just would take two more votes. If this opinion picked up steam and other people thought this was a great idea, I'd want to know what that means for me as an ophthalmologist, or for that matter, any other medical specialty. What are the conditions under which I am practicing medicine? Now, again, just by way of review, we've heard from the majority the circumstances before this case with respect to practicing medicine. What was the expectation of me as a physician in practicing medicine? I would only be held liable if, with respect to the majority prior to this case, if I didn't meet the standard of the profession. So what I would know as a physician prior to this case is, I keep up to date, I read the literature, I go to the conferences, I talk to my fellow wizards about what's going on in the profession. I stay up to date. I meet that standard. Standards good, bad, or indifferent, but if I meet that standard, no one can say that I was behaving negligently. As of this case, the majority announces, oh, by the way, the jury and us judges, while we're at it, are going to make our own independent evaluation. So you got to meet the standard of the profession, but oh, by the way, we will too we'll review that, and if we decide the profession's not good enough, we may haul off and make you pay for these injuries. Again, I think as a physician, I would be rather alarmed at that prospect, and I would go to cocktail parties with my fellow doctors and rail about these arrogant, pushy lawyers. But, again, the majority has made it clear what the standard is. What is the concurring opinion telling us, if they were in charge, under what circumstances would a physician have to pay for an injury suffered by one of the physician's patients? What triggers liability according to the concurring opinion? What's that? Obviously, if my patient gets hit in an automobile accident on the way to coming to my office, I don't have to pay for that. But what kinds of injuries will I have to pay for? I have to pay for this one. What is it about this one that means I have to pay for it? Okay. But no, wait a second. Say that again. Well, as you put it that way, that should have died. That sure sounds a lot like a negligence standard. See, this is where I, as I said, not being insincere about it, I'm not sure I understand the concurring opinion, because remember that the concurring opinion started out, used this idea of strict liability. But if, in fact, what they're saying is what you say they are saying, and it may very well be that you're right about it, what the concurring opinion is saying is they should have diagnosed this condition. That means, I gather, that what we're saying is they're negligent. We don't want to use that word. We don't want to hurt their little feelings, you know. They stay up late, you know, they have all these medical, they're a cranky bunch, these doctors, so we don't want to make them mad, but if you ask us what we think is really going on, we'll say, well, they should have diagnosed this, you know. So the concurring opinion maybe is agreeing with the majority that they were negligent, but the concurring opinion wants to provide this little fig leaf here to protect them from being exposed to some embarrassing accusation that they were negligent. That's one reading, but I'm not sure that's what they really meant. Mr. Nance? Okay, Now, I hope you hear the difference between those two ways of looking at it. What you're suggesting, Mr. Nance, is that there could be liability without negligence. Not just the word, not using that word, but we're not even thinking that. What we're saying is, look, doctor, no one held a gun to your head and said you had to go to medical school. You chose this profession. It has its benefits, but it also imposes risks. And when bad things happen in the course of it, you're going to have to belly up to the bar and pay for it. Now, that rationale we haven't seen yet, but if I may look into the future of the cases we're about to read, where do we hear that kind of logic? Yeah, Sigler versus Kuhlman, carrying large quantities of gasoline. The court says to the defendant, you choose to engage in this risky activity, you're going to accept the downside, you'll take the bitter with the sweet. Is the concurring opinion, do you think the concurring opinion is saying that to the doctor, and would it make sense in this particular case, Ms. Johnson? Well, this is another little possibility, another path we might take here, which is essentially, in some ways, going back to the majority's opinion and the concern about how do we really know what is the standard of reasonable care and when it's been violated in these technical matters that involve medical care and judgments and anatomy and, you know, biochemistry and all these complicated things. How realistic is it for us to expect that juries are going to understand the subtleties of this and make good decisions? But I'm not sure I know what the cure for that, so to speak, would be if, in fact, we have this problem that we're passing judgment on doctors and few of the people who are passing judgment, not the judges, not the jurors, have much by way of medical training. But does that mean that we then sort of impose liability sort of as a, it would seem like it could cut the other way just as easily to say, what are we doing imposing liability on doctors when who knows whether they were really negligent or not? Ms. Harkins? But why is it any more fair to make the doctor pay? Okay, now notice that on this point, you're absolutely right. That's what that's one of the things the concurring opinion talks about. And what makes this case so difficult but interesting and fun to play around with is the fact that they do say different things in different parts of the opinion, and it's sort of like, you know, the blind man with the elephant. You know, I think I've identified what kind of animal I have here because, well, over here it looks just like this. So in one part of the opinion they are talking about the relative ease with which either the doctor or the patient can bear a loss that we will assume for purposes of discussion is nobody's fault. It's not the patient's fault, it's not the doctor's fault. Somebody's going to be saddled with the cost of this glaucoma. And the concurring opinion thinks it's better that the doctor, rather than the patient, bear that. Why? Because the doctor has more resources. Through insurance or otherwise, the doctor is better situated to spread this loss. So, in effect, what the court, I mean, this goes back to our another of our old friends, Judge Younger, you know, back, you look at Mrs. Bierman's case, one of the functions of the tort system here, one of the things we like about the tort system, according to Judge Younger, is it accomplishes this cost-spreading function. Little Mrs. Bierman is not as well situated to bear the loss from water main breaks as the city of New York. The plaintiff in this case is not as well situated to bear the loss as the doctor. But again, inquiring minds want to know, in future cases with future patients, when may I anticipate that I will be held liable for a patient's injury? What is the standard by which a patient can come forward according to the concurring opinion? And the concurring opinion says, in this case, doctor, you have to pay for the plaintiff's injury. Ms. Ma? Yeah? I think the concurring opinion is, first of all, identifying this case as pretty rare. The concurring opinion is saying, and I don't think the concurring opinion has in mind that a patient who comes to the doctor, let's say, with a rare form of cancer that starts in the eye and then moves into the brain and you're dead. And, you know, the ophthalmologist, schedules an appointment, this person comes in, the doctor looks at it, runs the test, and says, gee, I have terrible news. You've got cancer, and based on, past experience with this, you'll be dead in 3 months. And sure enough, the patient is dead in 3 months. And the estate of the patient then sues the doctor and says, this is a very rare form of thing. You're in a better position to bear the loss than we are. You have to pay. Would the concurring opinion, do you think, impose liability in that case? Ms. Harkin, you're shaking your head. No, why not? You mean they were negligent? See, this is. Will somebody please straighten this out for me, because it no sooner do you think you have it here than, oh, no, what we're really talking about, forget all this strict liability baloney, what we're really talking about is cases where they're negligent. We don't want to impose liability when the doctor didn't do anything wrong. And again, notice the difference between what Mr. Nance was saying and what you're saying. Mr. Nance is saying, if there is a coherent position that says, we don't care about whether you did anything wrong. You decided to become an ophthalmologist. Welcome to the club. It has pretty stiff dues here. One of the parts of the dues is when patients die on you, you pay for it, buddy. That's the deal. You don't like them apples? Go, do something else for a living. Yeah. I don't think, I said, that's a coherent position. What Mr. Nance was describing is a coherent position. I understand it, but it doesn't make, but it would be bonkers, I would think, from a public policy standpoint. No disrespect, I'm not sure you were suggesting that as your own opinion. My apologies if it was your opinion, but I think For one thing, let's think about it. The ophthalmologist didn't cause this person's glaucoma. The doctor failed to diagnose it, true, but if the doctor's failure wasn't negligent, if we're uninterested in whether the doctor was negligent, we simply say, your failure to do anything about it means you have to pay for it. We would have to say the same thing about the person with an incurable cancer that the doctor fails to cure. And we would say, because you're a doctor and because this person is your patient, you have to pay for your injury. Well, I think quickly, as Ms. Harkins was pointing out, a doctor who had to pay, no one would be an oncologist for sure. There might be some other, you know, maybe you could do liposuction for, you know, and make enough profit so that your occasional failures you could pay for. But if the medicine that you practice involves people that come into you sick and you can only save some of them and you have to pay for all the ones who die, you'd quickly run out of money. Or you'd have to charge such huge fees to the people you treated that it would become very difficult. So presumably, we're not going to go there. We're not going to treat people who practice medicine because it really wouldn't, again, it wouldn't make sense to treat doctors as though they had foisted, you know, as though they invented disease. If it weren't for doctors, no one would have cancer. Well, if it weren't for people driving around in tanker trucks full of gasoline, we wouldn't have fires of, you know, gasoline tankers. So if, you know, we can tell the people who want to do that, look, if you're not willing to bear the risk, find another way to make a living. And we'd be rid of that. But we can't do that with medicine, it would seem to me. Because doctors don't create disease. If they do an inadequate job of curing it, we can hold them liable for their negligence, but it really wouldn't make any sense to say that they are strictly liable, I don't think. Mr. Wright. Well, this opinion would change the way you practice medicine, I would think, as the majority, either the majority opinion or the concurring opinion. But in terms of the concurring opinion, if the concurring opinion were the majority, what? Tell me, is that what you're saying? Well, exactly. Oh, go ahead. They would have been better off if they'd been found negligent. Right. Eventually, they really were negligent. But that's just the concurring opinion. Let's make it clear. The majority says, despite what the jury says, despite what the profession says, we know this guy was negligent. Now, again, if I were a doctor, I would be alarmed at the idea that I am now answerable not only to a jury, but I'm answerable to what justices on the Supreme Court think of my procedures. So I'd review my procedures to look at things which are maybe common in the profession. All the folks in the profession who are used to this accept, well, this is the way we do things, but I ask myself the question, wait a minute, what would 9 people in black robes sitting in Olympia think about this? And if they would frown on it, maybe I should think twice about doing it. Now, that might be a salutary sort of check on the inbreeding of a profession. On the other hand, you might think of it as being, I'd rather be treated by a bunch of doctors, thank you, rather than be treated by 9 people with law degrees. Ms. Schmidt. But okay, so to understand this case really is all about negligence. Despite what the concurring opinion says, what we're really talking about is negligence and the Supreme Court's willingness to override what the jury and the profession says. And the concurring opinion is simply weird. We simply don't understand where these guys were coming from, except that it is a fig leaf. But they're actually being quite disingenuous and quite confusing in using the term strict liability when they're not really talking about strict liability at all. They're really talking about this intuition. Well, it'd be one thing if, you know, this had been a bolt out of the blue, but come on, 5, 6, 7, 8 times at the doctor and didn't spot her glaucoma? Give me a break. So, again, I'm comfortable with that reading of it, but again, it does put the concurring opinion in a rather bad light to the extent that they're not cutting square corners with the terminology that they use and what they say. The stuff Ms. Harkins read to us is baloney. They don't mean that. They're really talking about negligence. They have no intention of even if they were the majority the next time, of saying that a cancer patient who was a victim of a cancer that that reasonable care couldn't prevent, we'd hold the doctor liable because he's in a better position to afford it and spread the cost among his other patients. I can't imagine the concurring opinions really saying that. If they are saying that, then I would be alarmed in a different regard. But so something's not, we're not all, we don't have both oars in the water here. Ms. Peters? Yeah. Right. Here is where it seems to me there is a place for deference to the medical profession. And in our current environment, if I think my doctor has done a poor job treating me, I come in, I keep complaining, there's something going on, but they never... Well, recently my daughter, for example, was in the intensive care unit in the hospital. She had double pneumonia, as it turns out. This was about 2 weeks ago, actually. We had been on vacation, came back from vacation. My wife took my daughter to one of these doc-in-the-box places, the urgent care center, whatever. You go in there, and, they you walk in off the street, and they do whatever they do. And, well, they listen to her lungs. That's the standard thing. And she had walking pneumonia, as it's called, where you can't, it doesn't make the kind of rattle that regular non-walking pneumonia makes. The only way you can tell is by getting a chest x-ray. Fortunately, my wife was unsatisfied with this a couple of days later and just took her down to the emergency room, and they gave her an x-ray, or took an x-ray of her, and six doctors descended upon her and, said that they were very alarmed. She had double pneumonia and put her in intensive care, and she's fine now, off at school and so forth. But, there was a case in which I don't know whether I should have expected the doc in the box to have recognized this, or whether or not that's something that in the busy, you have case after case of cough and flu and cold and so forth. I would think that in order to establish, supposing God forbid, something serious had happened to my daughter. She, you know, died or suffered permanent injury because of the failure to diagnose it in a timely way. And I had sued the doc in the box in order to establish liability. I've got to find a doctor someplace who says, these are the circumstances in which you would order a chest x-ray. You wouldn't be content to just listen to her lungs and say, can't he, you know, sounds normal from the stethoscope here. See if she gets here, take these, you know, this cough medicine and bed rest, plenty of fluids, give her some, you know, ibuprofen for the discomfort, and then if she doesn't get any better in 5 days, come back. Maybe that's standard operating procedure, maybe it's not, but it's my burden as a plaintiff, if I want to get a medical malpractice judgment, I've got to find a doctor who will say this doesn't meet the standard of care. Now, the majority says, or it doesn't meet our standard of care. But the ordinary rule is, in effect, it doesn't really matter what I think or what you think a reasonably prudent doctor would do. It matters what the doctors think a reasonably prudent doctor would do. And if they say these things would have triggered further investigation, the chest x-ray, glaucoma test, I'm not getting to the bottom, we're not solving this problem, I got to think outside the box here, well, so be it. I get an expert and they prove that. But short of finding that expert who will say, I'm a doctor, I know what I'm talking about, this was substandard medical care, it's not enough that you or I speculate that, hey, you should have done better here. I don't really know. And personally, I'd rather have the doctors make that call than the lawyers who sit on the Supreme Court. Mr. Fowler. Well, there are two points of arrogance here on the part of the Supreme Court. One part of arrogance is to say, we, not the profession, are the final judges of good medical care. The second point of arrogance is to say that the jury, we don't need to consult a jury on this case. In fact, from the doctor's standpoint, remember how irritated the doctor would be at trial. The doctor is told, in effect, that the standard is according to the profession. That's the rule of law that's applied. It's not necessary for the doctor to try to argue the merits of the standard of care. The jury is told, here's the standard of care. Did the doctor meet it? That's the game we're playing. Up in the Supreme Court, now the game is, what do we think of this standard? We never had our day in court on that because you never told us that's what the game was. So, to the extent that this is now a free-for-all, we're going at it with the jury to say, should a doctor give a glaucoma test or not? Who cares what the profession says? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what do you think? At least you'd give the doctor a chance to say, here's why that standard of not giving it before...